28. An hour later, every wizard in Europe had managed to find his way back into Camelot. With that many people working on the problem, and Eddie to act as a guide, it didn't take long to reinstate the shell, deactivate all of Jimmy's macros, and remove the exclusion field from around the city. That all handled, it was time to turn to the task of punishing Jimmy. Philip made no effort to hide his glee. When he was asked to try, he pointed out that his obvious enjoyment of Jimmy's punishment was an important part of said punishment. They gathered in Jimmy's office. The only surprising bit was Eddie. He was angrier than anyone. He'd acted as a glorified secretary for years, hoping that someday Jimmy would let him in on his amazing plans. Then, all in one day, Eddie found out that the great man shared his scheme with someone else on a whim, that the plan itself was abhorrent and immoral, and that his mentor and closest friend was all too happy to see him torn to shreds by fake orcs with all of the other wizards. The wizards engaged in some heated deliberation in Jimmy's former office, while Jimmy was stored safely on the floor of his former waiting room, hogtied, naked, with a gag in his mouth. Finally, they brought him in to share their thoughts. The model of the new Europe was removed from the conference table. Jimmy was placed there instead. Jimmy's face was still stained red and streaming tears, but he'd regained some of his composure. They could easily send Jimmy back to his original time and place, but they had to make sure that he received some punishment for what he had done once he got there. Nobody was surprised to hear that Philip had some ideas. Gwen's levitation spell was used to hold Jimmy helpless in midair. Philip climbed up on the table behind Jimmy. He removed his hat and pulled out two fat grease markers, one green, the other yellow. Philip took his time, writing Brazil in large green letters, then used the yellow marker to write number one.
I looked up the day you left your time, Jimmy. Did you know that on that exact date there's a massive rally in Buenos Aires to show support for the Argentinian national football team? It seems they were about to play their arch-rivals, the Brazilians. Have you ever been to Argentina? It's a lovely country, full of strong, healthy, passionate people, most of whom hate the Brazilians with the intensity of 1,000 suns.
As Philip clambered down off of the table, Tyler spoke.
I wanted to ghost you, for at least as long as you ghosted me for. They all talked me out of it. Instead, we pumped up your magnetic field so strong that any electronic device within 10 feet of you would stop functioning, just like we did with Todd.
Tyler walked up close to Jimmy, savoring the only satisfaction he was likely to get.
You can't use a computer. You can't use a phone. If you try to get anyone to help you, it'll be by writing a letter or speaking to them in person. Either way, you'll sound insane. As you know, we've reset your stats to the original factory settings. You're aging again. You're able to get hurt. For Todd, we all figured that was a sufficient punishment. But you have a talent for getting people to do what you want. That's why we're stranding you in South America. You don't speak Spanish, do you? No, you don't. You'll spend the rest of your life an illegal immigrant in the penal system of a foreign nation where you don't speak the language, and everyone thinks you're insane. But you'll remember your time as Merlin. It's not quite like being a ghost, but it's close enough for me.
Eddie ungagged Jimmy, leaving him hanging in space. Jimmy knew better than to struggle. He was stuck, and any attempt to unstick himself would just entertain his captors. He looked at Philip and said,
"We'll meet again, you know."
Philip stepped forward and pointed his staff at Jimmy.
"Yes, in 800 years or so. Anything you want to say before we send you to your fate?"
"Yes."
"Too bad,"
Philip said, and sent Jimmy on his way. Eddie led Philip, Martin, and Gwen to the private chambers of the royal family. They weren't surprised to find that while they were very luxurious by medieval standards, they were a hovel compared to Jimmy's accommodations. King Stephen had died long ago. King Arthur, a thin young man in his early 20s, with a confused manner and large, questioning eyes, shared his quarters with his mother, the regally passive Queen Matilda. Eddie explained that Merlin was gone. King Arthur nodded and asked what that meant. Eddie explained that Merlin had left and wasn't coming back, ever. The king nodded, squeezed his mother's hand, thought for a moment, and asked, more emphatically,
"What does that mean?"
Eddie explained that Merlin wasn't going to be around to help him, and that life would go back to the way it was before Merlin arrived. Arthur said,
"But I wasn't the king before he arrived."
It was clear that without assistance, the monarchy would fall. That wouldn't be so bad, except that it would drag the rest of Europe into decades of bloody warfare with it. It was a terrible mess, but the wizards couldn't in good conscience just stand back and watch as the Merlin vacuum destroyed the fledgling Western civilization. It was decided that the wizards would elect a new chairman to act in the wizards' interests and to help prop up and guide the royal family into self-sufficiency. When time came to pick a chairman, everyone wanted to know what Philip thought, which said more than a vote ever could. Philip had no interest in living in Camelot, so his first act as chairman was to order Martin to act as his liaison to the royals, with Eddie's assistance. Martin argued, but Philip was firm.
"Martin, we all have to do our part. I don't want to be chairman, but that's what everybody wants, so I'm doing my duty."
"Yes, but..." Philip cut him off.
"As chairman, I order you, Martin, to do your part. It just so happens that your part is to do the vast majority of my part."
The wizards split into two groups, one to go talk to Jimmy's attempted orcs, the other to go talk to the elves. The orcs were delighted to hear that they would be turned back to normal, but less happy to hear that it would take several weeks. The group that went to talk to the elves reported that the only manifestation of Jimmy's work so far was that the entire town was thinner. So they were happy to leave things as they stood. That night, the wizards held the largest victory party of all time, when measured in terms of area. There were still only about 24 of them, but they had regained the ability to teleport, and having gone without it for the afternoon, they all felt like using it. The party started in Jimmy's former office, but soon some wizards wanted to see Philip's rec room, and others wanted to check out Skull Gullet Cave. Eventually, teleportation points were defined for several of the wizards' larger homes, and the event took on the feeling of a party held in a mansion, where one drifts from room to room, only in this case the rooms were spread all over Europe. The hardest part about throwing a party for time travelers was finding music everyone can enjoy. Everyone is invariably convinced that their artist, genre, format of choice is infinitely superior to all others. After making the obligatory rounds to see where everyone else lived and show them his empty storage facility, Martin settled into Philip's 80s-themed attic for the duration. But now it was getting late, and Philip was loudly explaining that Thomas Dolby had recorded more than one song. Martin decided he needed some air. Martin stepped through the open garage door and across the heavy wooden ramp that led to the hill behind Philip's shop. He found Gwen, sitting on the ground, fiddling with her wand and looking at the stars. Martin sat next to her. There were many things he missed about his own time, but he knew that if he ever went back, he would miss the medieval night sky. He knew it was the same sky, but it really wasn't. The lack of any light source brighter than a campfire meant that even here, on the outskirts of a medium-sized town, the sky was a spectacular vista of stars, far more than a city boy like Martin had ever realized were there. In his original time, a sky like this was a luxury he'd have to travel for hours out into the middle of nowhere to get. Here, on any clear night, he could just step outside and see the whole universe. After a period of time, Martin carefully calculated to seem nonchalant, he tore his gaze away from the sky and looked at Gwen. He opened his mouth to speak, but she beat him to it.
"I'm going to Atlantis. I'm leaving tomorrow,"
she said in a tone that left no room for questions. Martin wanted to say, "I'm sorry you got outed as a witch," but he didn't want to say outed, or witch, for that matter. Female wizard sounded stupid.
Lady Wizard was even worse. He tried to come up with a word that meant witch that didn't have any insulting or demeaning overtones. He couldn't. In fact, after some thought, he couldn't think of a word that meant female that men hadn't imbued with some belittling shade of meaning. Finally, after a much longer silence than he had intended, he simply said,
I can understand why. Frankly, I'm not sure why you stuck around here to begin with. You're a wizard. Why hide that and pretend to be a tailor?
Gwen said,
I wasn't pretending to be a tailor. I am a tailor, Martin. It's a fair question, though. I came here because I'd read a lot of fairy tales when I was a girl, and I wanted to see what the reality was like. I decided to stay here because I was a lot better than I expected. I mean, the food, water, and sanitation aren't great. But we have ways around all of that. As a peasant, I'm powerless, but I'm just as powerless as a peasant man, so that's a kind of equality. It's a pretty good time to be an independent woman, as long as you can defend yourself and nobody gets it into their head that you're a witch. Of course, I don't know if that's the way it always was, or if that's just our influence. Atlantis isn't just far away. It's also long ago, if you see what I mean.
I'm really sorry to see you go, though. She turned and graced Martin with the saddest smile he'd ever seen.
I'm sorry to be going, too. But most famous witch in medieval England isn't a title that comes with a lot of benefits.
Martin knew this was true. He kept his eyes on the stars and considered his next words carefully.
I've known you a while, but it's like I just really met you today.
Yes, Gwen said.
It is.
And that's my own fault, Martin continued. Gwen laughed gently before saying,
Yes, it is.
There was a long pause while Martin test ran several next sentences in his head before finally settling on the safest course of action. He turned his head to look at Gwen and said,
Well, I guess this is goodbye then.
She looked back at him and said,
Yes.
They looked at each other for a moment. Then Martin asked,
Would you mind if I kissed you goodbye?
Gwen smiled and said,
No.
Martin was thrown high into the air, silver robe flapping in the wind. He landed on the roof of Philip's shop, where he slid limply, flopping off the side and falling into the valley where the side of the hill met the wall of the shop. Gwen, radiating with glowing power, cursed herself and shut off her macro. She stuffed her wand into her pocket before rushing to Martin's side. He was lying silently in the gutter, not moving. She tried to roll him over, but the fall had wedged him into the dirt crevasse. And now that she was close to him, she could see that he couldn't extricate himself because he was laughing too hard. He finally regained his composure enough to get up, but as soon as he made eye contact with Gwen, they both started laughing again. They didn't make another attempt at a kiss goodbye. They both knew that was a much more fitting end to their relationship.